Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. We're up to part three of chapter four from my book, Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks. Touching History, Mount Lucania, 1967. Here we go. Summit acceleration. We pitched Lip Camp on the edge of the plateau at 13,500 feet and committed ourselves to the upper mountain. Here, even farther from the outside world, our views and attitudes changed. Since it was light all night, the time of day did not matter. Since we worked 7 days a week, the day of the week did not matter. Since we were committed, the week of the month did not matter. As long as it was summer, the month did not matter. It just happened to be 1967. A powerful acceleration toward the summits now fueled our elevation celebration. The next day glistened as we started for the nearest summit, which was Steele. Even with snowshoes on, we sank to our knees in the plateau's bountiful snow. When the others slowed, I took over the lead. I felt strong, was above 14,000 feet, leading toward a summit, and was precisely where I wanted to be. As I plowed across the eternal snows, Mount Logan rose above the plateau. It was my first view of this amazing mountain, and it rattled my reverie. Larger than some ranges, Logan was outrageously ostentatious. Ever the intellectual, Halpern intoned, "If you cut Logan off at the height of Lucania, the resulting plateau would have an area of 4 square miles and would be 10 miles long. Lucania and Steele could both fit easily into Logan." As we trudged in a trance toward Steele, Logan rose like an apparition for a long time. When the rope pulled tight, I heard Halpern's rational but stern voice calling, "How about a break?" I was in a deep delight and had led most of the way to Steele without considering my companion's needs. We stopped, ate some kippers and baker's boy, changed snowshoes for crampons, then carried on. Amazingly, even the smelly kippers did not break my romance, and our march toward this mysterious summit made me ever more resolute. As afternoon slipped toward evening, we cramponed up hard, sculpted snow ripples that reminded me of the steely snow high on Denali. The higher we climbed, the larger Logan loomed. Suddenly, we were on the summit in the wind. Since no one had been here since Washburn and Bates made the second ascent of Steele 30 years earlier, ours was only the third ascent of Steele, but it was a first ascent for me. Beyond these mere statistics, what was important was the intensity of the moment. Like Washburn and Bates, the few minutes we spent on top of Steele deeply etched themselves in my cells. Scripted by the cold, wild, wonderful wind, Steele's summit urged me to go higher, and I felt a strong pull in that direction. Steele's summit was both transcendent and temporal for me, since as we started down, I realized that we had a chance to go higher without transcending. Across the plateau, rising evening clouds framed a surrealistic view of Lucania, which gave a new meter to our march. We stumped back to Lip Camp in a fatigue-filled fog, then collapsed. Steele's summit climb had required 19 hours, but it was instantly worth it. In spite of the storms, avalanches, crevasses, and altitude, this place seemed at peace. It felt like home. This summit filled me with joy, and I found our efforts here to be a good model for my other life, and for peace. While views are ephemeral, my memories are forever, and these are definitely the days I remember. Camp Supérieur. We pretended that we were being smart, but it was just fatigue. The next day, we rested and sopped up energy for the big one. When Gary finished reading Moby Dick, he snapped the book shut, then looked wildly around the tent for something else to read. He was full of adventure and did not have to wait long. The following day, we plowed another trough for 4 miles to the western end of the plateau. Our effort in the Binky-like snow consumed and calmed us. Like Washburn and Bates, we enjoyed the last two downhill miles. When we stopped, we were at 13,500 feet, which was the same elevation as Lip Camp. As we packed a tent platform with our snowshoes, I recalled that one of my inspirations for this trip had been a picture in a French climbing calendar that showed two climbers standing outside a tent preparing for a summit climb. The caption read simply, Camp Supérieur. It didn't matter which mountain, what mattered was the climb, and I wanted to be in the picture. Here I was at my Camp Supérieur. Our summit climb would begin in a few hours, so we prepared carefully. We discussed the difficulties that Washburn and Bates had with deep snow on their summit climb, then chose a more direct route that we hoped would hold firmer snow. We planned to climb as long as necessary to reach the summit, so accordingly we packed a shovel, stove, food, and extra food. I had earned a reputation as the world's greatest post-holer and knew that Lucania would test me. All I needed was calories. In the evening, clouds swirled around our superior but still tiny camp, and I felt strangely suspended between two worlds. I understood glaciers, ridges, and summits, which obviously tested me, but the quiet hours in camp also tested me, especially when I was alone in my sleeping bag. Waiting for the climb with silent thoughts, I already knew that I had to climb. As I lay in my bag, I also learned that I liked just being here. I mentally crushed my eagerness, then dropped into a dreamless sleep. Suspended. Wham! One more step. Wham! Another step. This was not a dream. Lucania's reality was soft snow. Acres of cotton candy snow separated me from the summit, and my post-holing reputation was on the line. Wham! A new stride. We crept up the ridge, but when my companions asked if I needed relief, I hollered back, Nah, I enjoy the labor. Fires burned inside. Wham! A surging stride. Thus, whamming and rising, I led on into the clouds. Amazingly, I climbed beyond the clouds and emerged into clear skies. The only thing I saw was Steele Summit and Lucania's final slope still arcing above. Steele looked wild, stormy, high, and far away, but Lucania's summit was sunny and close. My suspended universe consisted of steps, breathing, and summits. My detachment was complete, and I pulsed on without breaking pace. When I pulled onto Lucania's summit ridge and saw Logan, I realized that there was more, much more. Halpern, Gary, and Mike joined me on the ridge and congratulated me on my lead. Our direct route had worked. Relaxing for a moment, we surveyed not just Logan, but a sea of summits. No glaciers, just ridges rising out of clouds. Our summit was only a few minutes away along a crest feathered by the winds. We reversed the rope and Mike led to the highest point while I watched the summit and my companions close to become one. Shortly after arriving on Lucania's summit, Halpern fired off a rocket that carried our suspended summit spirits even higher. It was a simple symbol of the transcendent mood we all shared. Having made North America's highest second ascent, I had a strong sense of history on Lucania's summit. It was July 8, 1967, and no one had been here since Washburn and Bates on July 9, 1937. It was 30 years, almost to the day, since their onerous first ascent. As I surveyed the myriad peaks of the St. Elias Range, I realized that I would not live to see another of these great huge peaks go 30 years without an ascent. Beyond the history, I felt privileged and empowered by the place. Relaxing my mood to include all the peaks within my eye's grasp, I realized that this was not just a transcendent summit, but that the entire range was transcendent. Listening to the puzzle pieces clicking into place and surging with the potency of my transcendent range, I looked anew at Logan, but without having to resolve anything, I knew that I would climb Logan someday. When I did, it would simply be part of the same transcendent climb that I was on now. Spring fever. Our summits had been detached and pure. Our descent from Lip Camp took on an anxious hue when a serious storm threatened to imprison us on our long-sought elusive plateau. I shuddered at the thought of a forward retreat over the top of steel, since we couldn't even see enough to descend, much less ascend. Additionally, our extra equipment and supplies were below us, not here with us. Every time the wind slowed a little, we hunched in our tent with packs at the ready, proclaiming it to be the storm's dying gasp. Knowing that the wind was just gusting, we waited through 100 dying gasps before finally descending into the storm, plowing down with the same vigor that had taken us to the heights. We reached Toe Camp, then the next day surged back past Wandhenge to reach the landing camp where Wilson had dropped off Halpern, Gary, and Mike. We dubbed this camp Lucania View. We had climbed our mountains, but could we escape them? In this era, long before affordable high-tech radios and touch-tone satellite phones, we would just have to sit here and wait for Wilson. We had made a schedule with him a month earlier, but that meant little now since his arrival here would depend on the weather and other factors. With no choice, we waited. On the first day, we counted, organized, and stacked our supplies. We had planned enough food to hike out if necessary, so we were not starving yet. On the second day, we tromped a long runway with our snowshoes. On the third day, we sat around debating how long we could or should wait before attempting the walkout. Recounting my inability to walk out from Denali and the Anderson-Chittenden mess that lurked below us, we all knew that a walkout would be a dying gasp. Nevertheless, how fast should we eat our remaining food? While I was taking a long lap on the runway well below camp, Wilson flew over. Leaping with surprise and delight, I started my long snowshoe shuffle trot back to camp to get ready for our departure. Then looking up, I saw Wilson toss out a note attached to a rock. In a knees-up sprint toward the note rock, I watched as Wilson's plane circled over our camp, then started back down the glacier toward me. Thrusting a bare hand into the snow, I retrieved the rock and unfolded the note that read, "I'm headed for Logan. Make me a longer runway. I'll be back in 2 hours. Barb is with me." I jerked my head up just as Wilson roared over and caught a glimpse of my beautiful wife waving at me. Then she was gone. I did not need to read the note again. Barb was in the plane with Wilson. Her quarter-second wave was real, my outer world flooded back, and I flopped into the snow. Suddenly it was no longer just my mountains. Barb was here with me. I had moved in with her upon arrival in Berkeley, and we had married over the Thanksgiving weekend in November 1966. Of course, our sky-high honeymoon included a cold peak. Barb and I were training for grand adventures together, but she had not been ready for Lucania, hence my trip here was without her. However, it was now clear that she intended to see Lucania View. Back in camp, we sprinted through our chores, then plopped on our packs to wait for Wilson and Barb's return. After 2 hours, I cocked my head, listening for the soft drone of the small plane, but heard nothing. Reasoning that whatever chore Wilson had to do over at Logan was taking longer than 2 hours, I waited patiently for a third, then a fourth hour. Nothing. With a Gordian knot tightening in my stomach, I waited for a fifth and a sixth hour. Nothing. Something was wrong. While repitching our tent for yet another night on the glacier, I finally let it out to the other guys. "She's down over at Logan. At a minimum, they're stuck, and my stomach tells me that they may have crashed." The usually imperious Halpern roared with a startling intensity. "She's not down over at Logan. There is some simple explanation. We just don't know what it is. Relax, Roach." As we would learn later, they were down over at Logan. The next morning, I started my nervous pacing on the now much longer runway, but the day drummed by like a formal funeral dirge. Nothing. Trusting Halpern's acute sense of events, but tortured by mine, we held a meeting to discuss who would fly out first. Applying the logic that I had been on the glacier for 5 days at the beginning of the trip, I won the coveted first spot. Late in the day, we heard the drone of freedom. Wilson appeared, circled once, then landed. Sprinting up to the plane, expecting to see Barb, I just found a grumpy Wilson. "Where's Barb?" I blurted. "Damn ski is stuck," was Wilson's reply. In another second, it was clear that Barb was not in the plane, and that the plane was indeed stuck. Tossing me an extra shovel, Wilson just grumbled, "Here we go again. You know what to do." "Where's Barb?" I blurted. This time I got an answer. "Back in Glen Allen. She's fine." "So something did happen," I roared. "I'll explain later. Start digging," was all Wilson would offer. When the plane was clear and positioned for takeoff, I said, "I'll get my pack. I'm first." Wilson, as crabby as I had ever seen him, just rumbled, "Forget that, Jerry. I'll be lucky to get off solo." Then he put one foot on the step, turned and gave me his, "I wouldn't land here again for $50,000, look," pulled into the plane, fired the engine, and roared down our coveted runway. He lifted off right at the end of our snowshoe tracks and was gone. In disbelief, we stumbled back to our tent space and repitched the tent for yet another night on the glacier. New turbid thoughts tugged at the corners of my now thrice-tousled mind. Tossing for hours, I finally dozed at 2 a.m. At 3 a.m. on July 16, I jerked awake to the roar of an airplane landing. At first, I thought I was dreaming and spent several seconds coming to. In those vital seconds, Halpern got the jump on me. Dashing out, dragging his bag behind him, he just chortled, "He's got the Cub!" Wilson had switched from his larger Cessna 185 to his much smaller Super Cub. This was the type of plane that Sheldon had used to fly us to Denali in 1963. Now Wilson was getting serious. While madly stuffing my sleeping bag and rolling my pad, I heard Wilson bellow, "Let's go! I need a man! I don't care who! Every second counts!" When I crawled out of the tent, I watched Halpern crawl into the plane and pull his heap of gear in with him. Wilson put his foot on the step, gave me his, "I'm going to take off this time, look," and blazed down the runway. Somehow, in spite of our agreement that I would fly out first, there went Halpern. The imperious one had pulled a fast one. Slicing my open palms through the air in frustration, I watched the plane approach the end of the runway. However, instead of lifting off, it came to a stop. In the next instant, my karma came back to me. I watched as a half mile below camp, a dark speck appeared on the glacier, then another one. That was Halpern, who would now have to lug his heap of gear back to camp. Then the plane taxied back toward camp. Lunging for my gear, I stood at attention. When Wilson arrived, he just belted out, "I'll make it this time in my tracks. Next man!" Folding my lanky torso into the cramped Cub, I sat on my pack in eager anticipation. Roaring down the now slippery Cub tracks, we gained speed rapidly and lifted off just before we reached Halpern. As we arrowed by airborne, I just waved at my friend with the Ph.D. in statistics. Wilson dropped me at a tiny airstrip that he called the Slot, near the confluence of the Chitna and Logan glaciers. While Wilson hurried back for the others, I spent an hour at the Slot by myself, while 1,000 spring fevers pummeled me. Every flower, bird, boulder, and bug leapt into my six senses. I rolled in a tiny patch of grass, then sprinted up the moraine to get a view of Logan. The view was distant, but having seen it up close, the peak was somehow even more impressive. Awash with success, I ran around in a glorious mood, sniffing the tiny flowers and sucking in the mountains. For a few delicious moments, I stood torn between returning to civilization and remaining with the heights, since my seventh sense knew that my transcendent climb here was not yet over. However, hearing Wilson's cub returning with the next man, who couldn't be Halpern, I resolved to complete my transcendent climb here with my new wife, Barb. When I finally unfolded from the plane back in Glen Allen, Barb sprinted across the tarmac with her red braid flying, timed her jump perfectly, wrapped her strong legs around me so tightly that it challenged my breath, cradling my head and nibbling in my ear as I carried her toward the nearest flower. Surcease! What had happened over at Logan? Wilson landed at the Standard King Trench base camp to draw off some supplies and not surprisingly got stuck. After taxiing to make a crude runway, he finally gave up, then tried to radio for help. Unable to reach anyone, he put Barb onto the glacier by herself and tried to take off solo. He finally made it and came back for Barb, but when I heard this story, my Gordian knot came right back. What if Wilson had crashed? Then Barb would have been standing on the glacier alone with no equipment. I resolved to take better care of my bride. As my Lucania trip settled in, I reflected on our illustrious voyage. The statistics alone were impressive, since we spent 28 days on the peaks, walked 72 miles, and gained over 28,000 feet. This effort was slightly larger than my Denali effort, which was understandable since we had climbed two peaks. I had now been climbing for 11 years and felt like an experienced old veteran, but in reality was still a young pup. Beyond the statistics, I had now touched greatness and history and experienced both a transcendent climb and a transcendent range. For the rest of the summer, Barb and I climbed and toured Alaska's Great Land. We backpacked toward Denali from Wonder Lake and climbed several small peaks. Vaunted views of Denali further shaped our inhalations. After visiting the Arctic Circle, we drove south in our tiny VW Bug. By pre-arrangement, we met Bob and Mitch Working and Steve Anderson in the Canadian Rockies and did some climbs above the Columbia ice field. I was not just overflowing with adventure. I was beginning to believe that I could climb full-time. Reluctant to leave Canada and Logan's touch, I lazed by a lake in Waterton Park, carefully studying the routes on the cumulus clouds drifting overhead. When it became clear that I had no intention of moving, Barb took my hand and whispered in my ear, "Jerry, we have to go back to Colorado. We're running out of money." Flashing my degrees, I had a good job a few weeks later as a math analyst with the Denver Research Institute, so we rented a small place nearby to begin my post-school career. Through the winter, our life of marital bliss matured, but all I had to do was flip a mental switch, and there I was on top of Lucania looking at Logan. Lucania really taught me how to do an expedition, and this trip produced a stupendous third movement to my Northern Mountain Symphony. Still only a pup, I had climbed 6 of North America's 10 highest peaks. However, the list of great peaks that I was lusting after was growing, not shrinking, and I was learning how tough the remaining peaks would be. I had not forgotten Foraker, but I had now seen Logan. Stay tuned for Chapter 5, Logan's Light, Logan, 1973.